I'm Tyler Smith.
And I'm Alexandria Hadara. Welcome to Global Takes, America's number one podcast discussing global issues from the Black perspective.
It's time for our voices to be at the forefront of foreign politics and innovation. This is Global Takes.
Of emergence and overseas tonight, a potential escalation in the war in Ukraine. Russia accusing Ukrainian helicopters of attacking an oil storage facility.
Hundreds were able to escape the hard-hit city of Mariupol today, but a larger planned evacuation was delayed amid constant Russian shelling. Meanwhile,
the Ukrainian leader was soliciting more military aid from President Biden. An all-female delegation of Ukrainian members of parliament was in Washington for meetings with U.S. lawmakers, like this one with House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. They're in D.C. asking for more sanctions and weaponry like fighter jets to boost Ukraine's defenses. Their very presence is a reminder of what's at stake.
White people first, Indian people, Arabic people, before black people. As long as you're black, no one likes you. I remember they punched a certain black guy, a policeman in Ukraine, punched a certain black guy for nothing. He was shocked for nothing. Yes,
just when like we thought we were trying to find normalcy during the pandemic and the world looked like it was slowly going back to normal, then Russia invades Ukraine. NATO, the United States, and Europe scramble to address the war, struggling to de-escalate tensions. Meanwhile, Ukrainians were fleeing from bombs and explosions. African immigrant students were discriminated at the Ukraine border and stuck in the country. The world is in complete chaos. Today on Global Take, we're going to talk to Black foreign policy experts and practitioners to get a view on the Black perspective on the Ukraine war. This is Global Take.
Why should Black Americans care? I am going to start with the Americans first part and then get to the Black part, okay? In terms of intersectionality and, double consciousness and all that stuff. So,
this is Nola Haynes. She is the West Coast Director of Women of Color Advancing Peace and Security and has been featured in The Griot and The Cross Connection with Tiffany Cross on MSNBC. She is also a PhD candidate at University of Southern California for Political Science and International Affairs.
One of the reasons that make this situation very different from, say, some of Russia's other invasions or occupations or proxy wars, whatever you want to call them, this situation in Ukraine in 2022 is different from some of Putin's other kind of strategic moves to shore up Eastern Europe against how he feels an encroaching NATO West. Okay. So in terms of the threat of a world. And number two is because, you know, we're already feeling the impact. Yesterday, when I passed the gas station, premium gas was $6.13. And where I live, it's always high and it's been rising. Like it's been at $5 for a minute, right? So we're going to definitely feel that pinch as we're feeling at the gas station. And considering that Russia and Ukraine is responsible for a large portion of the world's grains, like wheat, sunflower oil, that's definitely something that we will feel in America in terms of prices rising at the stores and, you know, your dinner table, the food around your dinner table is going to go up. And especially with a lot of Black folks kind of moving into more of a healthy, holistic kind of vegan space, like a lot of the grains and oats and stuff that are imported are from Russia and Ukraine. So that's going to have an impact on people's diets, right? So that's just kind of like the bare bones of why we should care. But I cannot stress the World War III part enough. You know, I cannot stress that part enough. In terms of the why should we care as Black folks? Well, it's more of a question of how do you see yourself? You know, how do you position yourself in all of this? Do you just think of yourself as a Black person and not an American? And if that's the case, then what does that mean for you? You know, maybe you don't care and you go on about your everyday life. I care because this is what I do, you know, and watching everything that's happening, it's horrifying to a person like me that is not only a political scientist, an international relations political scientist to be exact, but a lot of that training has a huge historical part. So, you know, when I see Putin using similar explanations as to what Hitler used in 1939 and, you know, lands that was lost and that are rightfully Germany's or rightfully Russia's, that's scary, you know, to see the way in which he's just pretty much going for a total destruction in Ukraine. It's very similar to what did not happen when Hitler wasn't stopped in Poland. So it's like all of these kind of different features that we're seeing that could easily lead us into the next World War III, which will completely reshape the entire international system. And I'd argue that that is already happening.
Right, right. Wow, I mean, that, now, when you say reshape the entire international system, what does that mean in the late terms? Like, especially as it relates to Black Americans, what do you mean by that?
Well, what I mean by that is Russia has always been a big power player. Even if their economy, wasn't and isn't as thriving as say the US economy, they've always had a big presence. First of all, they have the largest just block of land. Let's just put that out there. They have the largest block of land on the planet. So there's that. And secondly, you know, it's a very, very, very old culture. It's a monarchical culture that, you know, left the monarchy structure and then went off into some form of communism to democratic socialism, with more of a mix of communism bringing in capitalism. So it's like this hybrid kind of situation. But Russia's been around for a long time. You know, Russia was a key factor in World War II. And, you know, obviously the Cold War. So this relationship has existed for a long time. And under Putin, Russia has definitely built up its defense mechanism. And because of that military prowess and because of the defense mechanism and because they have the most nuclear, they have the most on the planet, actually. They have about 6,000. And all of these things makes Russia formidable, right? So that's definitely going to be different once we move forward and see what sort of resolution will be met. But I think that Putin decapitated his own country. You know, I think this move, which is very similar to what happened to the USSR in 1975 when they went into Afghanistan, they were doing too much. Point blank, simple. They are doing too much right now. You know, for years and years and years, you know, growing up in America, any movie you watch that had a terrorist or a hijacker before it moved to brown people, it was always Russian. You know, Russia was always
the answer. True. That changed everything, right?
Right? Okay. It was always the lied the Russian, you know, with those horrible, horrible accents that people do. And that kind of went away for a little bit. You know, the relationships were kind of changing over time. And now, not only will Putin be a pariah, you know, but Russians once again will have to live through that horrible kind of period where they're going to have to recover their reputation. And that may take a very long time. I mean, it took Germany quite a while. Mm-hmm. And Germany had to, like, really reconcile with itself, you know. So the Russia piece is going to be different. They're going to be different alliances. Africa is going to play a role in this somehow, in a different way. Every single country is going to play a different role. Even Germany, who had historically for the last 75, 80 years have had like a no military buildup foreign policy, that's out the door. Chancellor Scholz has directed a lot of money towards their defenses. So that in and of itself, having a strong German military is going to reshape the international balance. And then you have Switzerland waking up and saying, we're going to come in with you all and make sure they can't do their banking. all of these different players who have been either neutral or kind of like pacifistic, all of these different dynamics are shifting, right? And just like with World War II, the US is right in the middle of it once again. So we'll see what will happen. And then, you know, you have China. We still don't know what's going on with China and all of this, right? So that's what I mean about the whole international system reshaping itself. And the last thing that I'll say is, this is one of the strongest tests for NATO and all of the liberal institutions that were built after World War II. And so far, the security alliances are working, right? So we'll see if NATO gets built up even stronger, adds more countries. We'll see if the UN gets stronger, the Security Council, because I doubt that Russia can have a seat at the table after this. So that's going to, shape things at the Security Council.
Oh, wow.
So there's going to be all of these different shifts these dynamic shifts. Even if there's a regime change in Russia, I doubt that they will still have the same sort of power that they once had. So it's going to be interesting.
Wow. Well, you said so much there to unpack, but I guess one thing I want to talk about, you said that this is the closest we've been to World War III. I know we had our first Black Secretary of Defense, Lloyd Austin, and our diplomatic efforts are some say our economic sanctions are starting to wane, that if Russia attacks, then Biden would have to look to Austin to recommend America's next military moves. What are your thoughts on U.S. military taking action? Is it too early to have this conversation, or just kind of want to get your thoughts on that?
Well, I think the Biden administration is right in not wanting to cross the red line in terms of direct involvement, because what people have to realize is that Ukraine is not a NATO partner. Yeah. Now, Ukraine is an ally, Ukraine is a friend. Now, what makes Ukraine important is that it is right in the middle between the Eastern Bloc and the NATO Western Bloc, right? So Ukraine has a very, very central and interesting role in all of this. And as we know, Ukraine's been wanting to move more west. They're a democracy, not only that, they, for the most part, and especially now, they don't want any parts of Russia. We want our own independence. Y'all said we could have our own independence. You signed a document saying we can have our independence and sovereignty. What y'all doing? So they want their own independence and they want to be more Western democratic leaning. So in terms of our military involvement, I can imagine, I'm not a military person. I do have a lot of friends in the military, and I talk to a lot of my friends about the situation a lot, just in terms of strategy. It's hard to watch Ukraine get destroyed. However, do you drag the US and the West of NATO into a direct conflict with Russia? Do you want two nuclear powers going up against each other when Putin has already started securitizing like the second or third day that he will definitely go to his nuclear arsenal? So that's really the most important part of this strategically. How much can we do without directly engaging with Russia, which will then absolutely trigger World War III?
Wow. Yeah, I mean, that's scary. Like, I don't think this generation has ever felt like that tension at like where we are now. So do you feel like, I mean, if we were to go to war, I mean, what does that mean for the Black community in terms of like Black soldiers are, they're oftentimes on the front lines of the battlefields. What does that mean?
I'm glad you brought that up. That's one of the points that I made in my op-ed, not only will we feel it, well, we are feeling it at the gas pump and at the dinner table, but we're talking about physical Black bodies being shipped off, to fight a war. And, since this country's been countrying, we've been doing that. So, we've always been involved in war whenever the U.S. has needed us. But absolutely, as the country diversifies, that means that you have more of more bodies able to go into the military. Now, the interesting part about that is if it did get to that point, and I really, really hope that it doesn't, people were not exactly, you know, signing up to be in the military like that anymore. So okay. The question that I have is, if we get to a critical situation, will the draft come back? You know, and then what would that mean for Black and Brown folks? You know, so it'll be, I hope we do not get down that road. You know, that would be like a last kind of, that's a desperate move. You know, if the country needs to start moving in that direction, that definitely means that, you know, things aren't going very well. But the physical bodies of Black men, Black women, Black theys, you know, definitely would, it would probably be a critical mass. And that frightens me. It definitely does frighten me, because, you know, what does that do for families? What does that do for the economy? What does that do for communities? You know, at WCAPS, you know, the first thing that we always think about is women. And, you know, women in times of war and conflict, they are always, always left with the toughest burden, because not only, say, for instance, if you're a soldier, not only do you have to go off and fight, you may have a family at home that you were thinking about. And what if you don't come back, right? Or what if you are at home with the children and your partner doesn't come back, right? So it just shifts so many family dimensions, and it takes generations to recover. You cannot be left to just run roughshod over Ukraine, because if he's left to run roughshod over Ukraine, who's to say that the Baltic states are next? Or who's to say, you know, he'll just keep going, like the guy in 39, you know, he'll just keep going and keep going, because he wants to rebuild, you know, the former USSR, the Soviet Union. And that he wants that to be his legacy. So in order for him to do that, he has to invade and occupy the lands that were lost when the USSR fell. So I feel bad that his people have to suffer because of him. I really do. I also, as a foreign policy person, as a strategist, I also see the need for making sure that Putin gets no further than where he is now.
Okay.
Man has got to be stopped. His military engine has got to be stopped. The world cannot, you know, burst out into World War III. It's just, I don't even want to think about that. I don't even want to fathom that. So, you know, in terms of activism, I think the racial things that have been happening, the identity related things that have been happening, like at the border with the African students.
Right.
I was in a Twitter spaces yesterday, and some of the students were in the room. Were you in there?
Yeah, I listened to that one. That was good.
Yeah, it was really good. And, you know, it was very interesting, because some of the African students were like, yeah, you know, it's not really the whole race thing, you know, it's just more about it's Ukrainians first. And some students were saying that they got that they understood that it's war. And then, you know, some other students were more upset. So I think those things are very important. Mm-hmm. I also think so is preventing someone who clearly has designs on war and expanding their territory. That cannot happen, right? That cannot happen. And so while I think Ukraine has to come to terms with itself, Poland and a lot of these countries who are just now waking up and realizing that they're an other, you know, hello, welcome to other world, you know, they have to face themselves, and they need to do some deep soul searching about their own identity bias and their own internal racism. there are all these different things around identity, and I think all of these things are important. What I do think, though, right now, the most important thing is to stop this invasion, first and foremost, and then to figure out what's going to be done about Putin. Those are the two priorities.
Okay.
Africans suffer at the border in Ukraine definitely added a different dimension and changed the conversation on the U.S. on Russia's invasion in Ukraine. Today we're going to talk to Violet. She was a Peace Corps volunteer in Ukraine, and she's going to talk about her experience.
My name is Violet Esipela. I served in Ukraine from 2017 to 2020. I did youth development, and I also did work with an NGO that focuses on PEPFAR programs. What I did there, I worked during my first assignment, which is a 2-year assignment. I worked with a small community in a village where I was able to teach English, provide teachers with teachers training through a small grant program. I did focus on more youth in the community with introducing them to community leaders and assisting them with confidence to speak with community leaders. With my second assignment, I worked with an NGO that focused on PEPFAR program. Unfortunately, this particular program was a short program, half a year due to the evacuation back in 2020 due to COVID-19.
Are there many Black volunteers in Ukraine? And can you just talk a little bit about the Black experience, or your Black experience in Ukraine, if you will? What was that like? Did people stare at you, or were they curious about you and where you were from, or life in America?
Yes, absolutely. Yes. When I was in a small village, as I've mentioned, I was the only Black volunteer there. It was a university, it's a college university next to the village where I was assigned. So they were mostly mistaken me as an African student at first, when they would see me like taking buses, mashutka they call. It would be a lot of stares. They would look at me curious, particularly in the village. They would ask, well, what are you doing here? I said, I'm an American, a volunteer, and I'm teaching English here at the local state school. So they were curious. Some, you know, they would say, well, why, you know, are you here, you know, teaching English as a volunteer? It was a lot of curiosity there among the community. And as you mentioned, as the Black volunteer, yes, during the time when I was serving, it was a handful of us as Black volunteers in Ukraine. In fact, we formed a group where we support each other through, you know, having discussions, meeting at least every couple months to meet for discussions and supporting each other.
Oh, I see. Okay. Well, and then speaking of that, it sounds like there were quite a few. So there were Black Peace Corps volunteers who were in Ukraine. Did you meet up with other Black expats in Ukraine or other African students living there?
Initially, I was in the village. It would depend if I would travel outside of my village. I would see African students. In fact, the first time I saw African, I was in Kyiv. I was like, oh my God, you know, I was so happy. You know, how I had this smile on my face, you know, oh my God, you know, I'm seeing someone else, you know, and they looked at me like, well, why is she smiling at me?
They thought you were you thought they were your cousin or somebody.
Yeah, exactly. So I did experience that outside of my village, because it's it's a village, it's far away from the city, and it's very rural area where I was.
Did you feel respected as like a Peace Corps volunteer? I mean, I'm assuming that this particular neighborhood received volunteers before. Did you encounter any hostility, or did you feel welcomed in your village?
So in the village, I was the first volunteer there, mm-hmm. the first American volunteer. It was a lot of questioning why I'm there. They were confused of what I was doing there. But yes, it's a small community. I was welcomed in the community. They, me engaging with the students. It was challenges there in the beginning because they were getting to know me, and it took time for them to get to know me. But I connected with, through students, I connected with other leaders in the community where we were able to form a project and to benefit teachers and the students.
Oh, I see. Okay. All right. Well, that's good. I mean, it's great that you were able to connect with the locals and get to know the Ukrainian culture. What would you say was the African experience like before the war in Ukraine? And I know that's quite generalized, but I mean, what was your impression of African immigrants in Ukraine? Like, what were they doing there? And was it like a temporary place for them just to get educated, or were they fleeing from their own political problems in their own home countries? Could you like talk about a little bit about Africans in Ukraine?
But I would focus, I was in the village, I was isolated. And then when it was time for us to meet with other volunteers, we'll meet on a monthly basis. And that's when I would see other African students, which I did not know was actually African students in Ukraine. So I would see them, I would say hi, we'll have a short conversation. But I knew that most were there for studies, mostly medicine. Medical.
Did you encounter like any police or any government officials? Because some European countries, like for example in France, I've heard stories of Black immigrants who, when they walk down the street, they have to carry their papers because they might be pulled over or stopped for immigration purposes. Do you see that? Did that happen to you or other Black immigrants, in Ukraine?
So I can speak for myself.
Okay.
To me, when I was in Ukraine, I counted that in my village, because like I said, I was the only Black volunteer in the village, and so I would walk a lot in the village. I literally would walk even to the next village over. It was on police, they did not have uniforms. And they identified themselves as police. They wanted to know who I am. They thought I was an immigrant. So during that time, I was near actually my flat. And thank goodness, my community is a small village. Everyone knew me, who I was. So I was able to, they were able to identify, confirm who I was. And then I also had to call the Peace Corps security, who called them to confirm who I was, because I didn't have ID. And in the village, I knew that everyone knew me, so I didn't need to carry a passport with me. Post-Vitka, it's like an ID in Ukraine with me in the village. So that was surprising to me. So that was the only incident that happened. But as far as me traveling outside my village, I did not encounter that, because then, and again, I speak on my behalf. Everything is in my own opinion and on behalf of any government. But it was... it was hard for me to see that. And to me, I thought, okay, you know, as Peace Corps, we have been there for years, and we have tried, at least me representing myself as a Black American, also as an African, a Kenyan, you know, African, you know, I represented, I wanted to ensure that, yeah, they need to see who we are. You know, most of the time, you know, due to this treatment, with how we are perceived in media, social media, you know, representation matter, you know, so when I saw that, it was disheartening. For the fact that now we are more on media, where it's a lot of like representation among us, you know, but it's progress. It's progress, but I was disheartened, and I know there's a lot of work that needs to be done in this area.
Touched a little bit about African immigrants and just them, you know, being pushed back, and some have faced discrimination, and there is a diversity of thought of what from just being in the African community, there's a diversity of thought on what racism is. So I'll put that out there. They don't define it the same way as Black yes. Americans do.
Yes. So I lived in West Africa for a while, so I completely agree.
Yeah. So just wanted to know, like, what are your thoughts on like how the Ukraine handled the refugee border crisis, and particularly as it relates to African immigrants? Do you see like any parallel between like Ukraine officials towards African immigrants and U.S. Border Patrol against Haitian immigrants?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, othering is such a layered thing. And, you know, the first thing that triggers a person to other you is your skin color. You know, it's like a visceral response, right? And so especially when you're in a heightened stress moment, you know, we kind of like fall back into our silos, into our identity kind of communities that kind of keep us safe and warm, so to speak. And I think, and also, you know, you kind of really see people in stressful moments, right? Yeah, you kind of really see who they are. And I think that Ukraine needed to confront itself on this. You know, while they may be welcoming to your face and they may not discriminate per se, or, you know, in a really overt way, for the students at the border trying to get into Poland to be treated like that, that has to exist within the culture, right? So I have a hard time believing that that's the first time that that came up. So what I'm trying to say is, when things are going well and the country's doing well, you know, you can smile and greet people, but when it comes down to it, and then the real you comes out because you're stressed and you don't have time for the fakeness and the veneers, and the real you comes out, then that's when you got to stay and look at yourself in the mirror like, okay, I have some identity bias issues that I need to work on. And, you know, once whatever the outcome is going to be for Ukraine and a lot of these countries, you know, a lot of these Eastern Bloc countries, you know, a lot of these European countries, you know, they need to really come to terms with themselves. And so does this country. You know, this country, it has not confronted itself in a real impactful way. And until we do, our enemies and frenemies will continue to exploit our number one weakness. And it is racism, period. Wow. period. It is the number one destabilizing factor in our country.
Wow, that is. And I don't think, you know, activists, I don't know. I just don't get the sense that people try to draw those international parallels to what's happening in the United States and use, you know, I just don't see that in terms of how they're thinking, how we should shape our policy and our foreign policy. Like, I don't see them seeing racism, at least those who are shaping our foreign policy are seeing racism as it's like a way for us to, as a way for our enemies to use that to against us, if you will.
Mm-hmm. there, you know, there definitely are a few folks like myself thinking about it. I just had a foreign policy paper come out with New America talking about anti-racism as foreign policy and how and how the U.S. needs to bake into its DNA a commitment to diversity. It needs to be part of the National Security Act. It needs to be codified. And I really do believe that, because we go out into the world and we talk about democracy, we talk about diversity being our strongest asset, but then we have this huge groundswell that's pushing against all of that, right? And people are seeing this around the world, right? So how can we show up as honest brokers when we are still dealing with our own stuff, right? So I think to repair a lot of these reputations around the world, it's more than representative activism. And what I mean by that is to have a few people placed strategically to give the appearance of diversity, but to really, 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 really have people that look like us really engaged and kind of redefining some of these very, very old ways of thinking, right? So by the vice president being very involved in his foreign policy situation, I think it's great. You know, yeah, I think that it's great that she's having an active role. You know, Ambassador Greenfield, you know, Ambassador Bonnie Jenkins, I mean, Undersecretary Bonnie Jenkins, you know, that, you know, these women are having active critical, you know, engagement and some of these things that are going on. And I think more of that needs to continue, more of that needs to happen. It cannot just be representative. It cannot just be like, oh, well, I have out of a staff, out of non-white people, out of a staff of like 10 white folks, I have 3 non-white folks, you know, like some quota system. No, hire people that will get the job done, who will be effective, and listen to new ideas and new perspectives and new concepts, right? Because we have the vantage point of experiencing the world that we're gonna have to live in for a long time, which no longer reflects, you know, the World War II world in which all of international relations and our national security apparatus comes from. We need new thoughts and new ideas, and space needs to open up for that. And I think to some degree it is, however, I know that there are a lot of problems still, and we have a long way to go, but I think it has to be this critical and real engagement of substantive representation. And what I mean by that is to hire folks who are qualified and to give them real responsibilities. Don't demean them, don't patronize them, give them real responsibilities, let them be a part of whatever this new world is going to look like, because it will be a new world one way or the other.
Oh my gosh. I never thought about it like this. And speaking of that, I mean, you can tell the repercussions in terms of our foreign policy. I mean, look at United Nations. Last Wednesday, South Africa was among 24 African countries that declined to join in a resounding vote, denouncing Russian aggression on Ukraine. And I think 16 African countries abstained, and some 7 didn't even vote at all. So what are your thoughts on that in terms of like you were talking about having that diversity of thought in those high level, those power play positions in terms of shaping our foreign policy? And you see the repercussions of this with what's happened at the UN.
Well, so, you know, I think Russia has some sort of security alliance deal with about 20 or more African countries. So that's the first part. Not tons of trade, but in terms of weapons and stuff like that, a lot of kind of security relationships. So that definitely factors in. And the fact that Russia and China saw opportunities in Africa in a way in which the US has not gotten involved, both positive and negative reasons, right? So in terms of how, and this is part of what I'm saying in terms of the shift, it's gonna be very interesting to see the role that Africa winds up playing in all of this, because I think that, you know, many countries recognize this as an opportunity to kind of, what do I wanna say? Kind of like upgrade themselves. Like they're different countries trying to get involved in like the diplomacy efforts, you know, between Putin and Zelensky. I think many countries see this as an opportunity for them to kind of like, you know, play a big role in this, because at the end of the day, they all want that reputational power, you know. And that's what the U.S. got in spades after World War II. They got that reputational power and just built on it, right? So it's going to be very interesting to see how the continent factors into this shifting, this international shift that's occurring. But, you know, while countries did, you know, they supported, some abstained, there was that powerful speech by the Kenyan
It was very powerful.
Ambassador. And, you know, he got.
This situation echoes our history. Kenya and almost every African country was birthed by the ending of empire. Our borders were not of our own drawing. They were drawn in the distant colonial metropoles of London, Paris, and Lisbon, with no regard for the ancient nations that they cleaved apart. Today, across the border of every single African country, live our countrymen, with whom we share deep historical, cultural, and linguistic bonds. At independence, had we chosen to pursue states on the basis of ethnic, racial, or religious homogeneity, we would still be waging bloody wars these many decades later. Instead, we agreed that we would settle for the borders that we inherited, but we would still pursue continental political, economic, and legal integration.
Some flack, you know, from people saying that he was, you know, giving too many props to the colonizers and stuff like that. But the part for me that resonated is when he was like, listen, y'all can call this what you want to, but I know what this is. This is imperialism. These are imperialistic moves. And so I think that that part of his speech got amplified and started to reshape the way people were thinking about what was happening. The way in which Putin did this in terms of traditional international relations thinking, that his actions weren't rational. Like you're gonna, like, you know, we've been hearing tons about what's rational, what's irrational. Well, perhaps it's rational if we understand what his motivation and what his ultimate outcome is. And if his ultimate outcome is to rebuild the Soviet Union and to, you know, retake those territories, then perhaps this is rational acting in terms of how he is envisioning what he's doing, right? So I feel like that speech helped take people out of their traditional ways of thinking.
Okay.
Like, oh, wait, wow, wait, maybe, you know, we need to recalibrate here, you know? So, and that is an example of how different ideas, different lenses and perspectives can add to the way in which we strategize national security and foreign policy. We see things differently because we live in the world differently, right? Mm-hmm. I see it very clear that our domestic instability around racism and white supremacy is being used against us. I see it very clearly, you know, makes me very nervous for Brittany Griner, to be honest. Like I've been thinking about her every single day. Mm-hmm. And the way that her, you know, her intersectional identities were targeted to use her, you know, in this moment, it infuriates me. And I think that this country, we really need to wake up. We really need to wake up to this situation. And, you know, because it's going to be our undoing, you know, it's already led to this. It's already led to this, you know, from the 2020 election to the big lie to 1/6, you know, to police brutality, to BLM, to everybody's watching the U.S., you know,
January 6th.
Exactly. Everybody is watching, you know, the foundation crack here.
Well, that does it for this episode of Global Take, where we discuss the Ukraine crisis from the Black perspective. Special thanks to our podcast team, Sydney Walters and Cheryl Galloway. Please join BPIA on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn. Thank you.